Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. News.
The country's chief epidemiologist has resigned from the health minister's advisory group on coronavirus. Overall confidence in the Czech economy rose in July, but consumers remained fearful due to the pandemic. And three Prague football clubs win their first matches of the First League season. Chief epidemiologist Rastislav Madjar has resigned from the Minister of Health's Coronavirus Working Group following the abrupt cancellation last week of newly announced measures to contain the virus. Madjar had since April led the working group of Health Minister Adam Wojciech, who last Monday announced that wearing face masks would become mandatory in most public indoor spaces as of September the 1st, along with other measures. Prime Minister Andrej Babiš later said aspects of the announced measures were inconsistent and incomprehensible, and Wojciech had to walk them back. According to the Czech news agency ČTK, Madjar wrote that he was sick of being subject to, quote, below-the-belt attacks, and had informed the health minister on Friday of his decision to step down. Minister of Health data show that 135 people in the Czech Republic tested positive for the novel coronavirus on Sunday. While that number is the lowest of the past week, it is also the highest for a Sunday since June. However, the recent uptick in cases stems from increased testing, not an outbreak, the health ministry says. Confidence in the Czech economy rose by 0.3 percentage points month on month to 87 points in August. Confidence among entrepreneurs increased but dropped among consumers, according to the latest Czech Statistical Office data. In an annual comparison, however, all confidence indicators remain lower due to the coronavirus pandemic and related measures. Consumers remain concerned about the deterioration of the overall economic situation, their own financial situation, and rising prices. Three Prague football clubs, including arch-rivals Sparta and Slavia, enjoyed victories over the weekend in the first matches of the Czech First League's 2020-21 season. Reigning champions Slavia soundly defeated SK Dynamo České Budějovice on Sunday by a score of 6-0, propelled by a hat-trick from striker Stanislav Tetzel. Sparta, which had a disappointing season last year, beat Zbrojovka Brno 4-1 on Saturday. The day before, the third division team from Prague, the Bohemians, 1905, beat Milano Boleslav by a score of 4-0. This year's edition of the Olomouc Art Brut Film and Video Festival will focus on four Czech figures from a genre also known as outsider art. The work of pioneering Art Brut figure and Olomouc local Anna Zemanková is featured on Thursday. And finally, the weather. Tuesday should be cool, with mostly clear skies throughout the country. Average daytime highs are expected to range from 22 to 26 degrees Celsius. I'm Brian Kennedy, and that's the Czech news for now.
Hi there, listener. This is Radio Prague International, and I'm Ian Willoughby. Today, Czech companies keep a close eye on Belarus. Some see the situation there as a risk, but others view it as an opportunity. People are risking heavy fines for fiddling with the speed restrictions on their electric bikes. And later we have a special guest, the European Commission's Vice President for Transparency and Values, Věra Jourová, discusses this information, Facebook and political content, and a lot more besides. All that's coming up in today's program. As protests in Belarus against President Lukashenko's regime continue, the situation is being closely monitored by more than 100 Czech companies that do business in the Eastern European state. Some see it as a risk, but also an opportunity, as Tom McEncrow has been finding out.
Russia is by far the most important economic partner of Belarus, but the country also maintains trade relations with several EU member states, including the Czech Republic. There are currently 162 Czech businesses registered in the post-Soviet Republic. Belarus ranks 44th on the list of Czech export markets. However, the Czech Republic is the 15th largest source of imports for Belarus. Keeping abreast of the quickly developing political situation is an important factor right now, says František Basopust, an executive director of the Chamber of Trade and Industry for the Commonwealth of Independent States.
Stability is important for any kind of business. That is the alpha and omega of successful business and economic cooperation.
While it ranks far behind countries such as Russia and Kazakhstan in terms of market size, Mr. Masopust describes Belarus as a gateway to the Eurasian area, a result of two factors, he says.
First of all, Belarus is the closest country to us geographically from the Commonwealth of Independent States. Secondly, Czech companies have positive experiences with their Belarusian partners because, and I know this may sound rough, the Belarusian worker is more disciplined and capable of maintaining technological procedures than others, which is very important in regard to any sort of production.
Charles University's Karel Svoboda is an expert on the Eastern European region. He says the gateway to Russia argument is the way in which Belarus markets itself, but it does not always work, because Russia maintains power over access through complex market legislation.
Officially, Belarusian producers have free access to Russia. This is like their comparative advantage, but unofficially, once Russians decide to block Belarusians or investors to Belarus from Russian market, they can do it.
One of the Czech companies active in Belarus is Metrostav, whose total worth of contracts in the Eastern European state exceeds 1 billion crowns. Currently, Metrostav is constructing a wastewater treatment plant in Brest. Company spokesman Wojciech Kostiha told Czech Radio that the current situation can be viewed from both angles.
Of course, we see the current situation in Belarus as a risk. Any sort of instability, whether internal or external, is unfavorable. However, we also see it as an opportunity. If the country changes its regime from autocratic to democratic, it can be assumed that the conditions for conducting business there will also improve.
Czech companies who were questioned by Czech Radio said that the political tensions have not impacted their business activities yet. However, some, such as AŽD Praha, a supplier of control and signalling systems for transportation, which sees Belarus as a key foreign market, warn against any sanctions that could impact business activity. Such sanctions have not been put in place by the EU, which has focused on punishing only selected members of the ruling elite. Karel Svoboda says sanctions that would impact the economy are unlikely in the future, not just because they could hurt European businesses, but also the opposition in Belarus.
Point is that, and I've heard it from Czech diplomats as well, that there is this sort of dilemma, because once you impose sanctions, the regime gets hardened. And it means there won't be any discussions, any possibility to help Belarusian opposition. So they will be left just for Lukashenko and for Russia, and this will be the end of this position.
And that report is by my colleague Tom McEncroe. Bikes, and especially electric bikes, have become increasingly popular during the coronavirus crisis. And as Czechs rediscover the long-forgotten joys of childhood, many are opting to unlock the speed limit on their e-bike, despite the risk of heavy fines. Daniela Lazareva has more.
With the onset of the coronavirus crisis and face mask regulations in public transport, many Czechs brought out their bikes as a fast and friendly alternative of getting around town. The sale of bikes and electric bikes soared, also as a result of the fact that most people holidayed at home this year and biking is a popular recreational activity. So given the time and attention people gave their bikes again, it is small wonder that many resorted to a bit of tuning in order to unlock the 25 km per hour speed limit on their e-bike and take this form of transport to a new level. According to the Road Safety Authority, BESIP, there are currently over 100,000 e-bikes in the country that have been tuned to exceed the set speed limit of 25 km per hour. Jakub Dietrich from the company Ecolo.cz confirms the interest in specially tuned e-bikes.
The software on e-bikes is set to stop providing electric assist once you reach a speed of 25 kilometers per hour. Now, on a regular bike, most people reach a speed of 28 to 30 kilometers per hour on flat terrain, so obviously customers see this as a setback. When we offer them trial rides on e-bikes set to speed limits of 25 kilometers per hour, 32 per hour, and 45 kilometers per hour, they always opt for the fastest bikes.
Nejvíc zákazníky bavilo to kolo, které jede nejrychleji.
E-bikes can be tuned to a speed of 50 kilometers per hour, which is the speed limit for cars in towns and cities. Lukáš Kadula from the Prague-based Institute for Road Safety says that while it is not illegal to tune e-bikes to higher speed limits, such bikes can only be used on private property and have no place on Czech roads or even cycle paths.
V momentě, kdy opravdu jede v tom režimu asistovaného šlapání.
The minute that a cyclist on an e-bike uses electric assist to exceed the 25 km per hour speed limit, they are breaking the law. They're basically driving a vehicle that technically is not authorized to be used on Czech roads.
The 25 km speed limit for e-bikes is valid not just in the Czech Republic but around Europe. A speed of up to 50 km per hour is considered extremely dangerous even for cyclists wearing full protective gear, and traffic police in France or Germany do not tolerate violations of the law. Traffic police in the Czech Republic have so far been more benevolent, also because they often lack the necessary technical equipment to measure the precise speed of e-bikes. However, under Czech law, cyclists caught exceeding the 25 km speed limit can be fined up to 10,000 crowns.
And that report was by Daniela Lazareva. Now, in the final part of our programme today, I speak to the European Commission's Vice President for Transparency and Values, Věra Jourová. We discuss this information, Facebook and political content, and much more in this edition of One on One. As the European Commission's Vice President for Transparency and Values, Věra Jourová's work is focused on a number of important areas. These include ensuring member states respect the rules of the European Union, combating online disinformation, and advocating for transparency in election campaign advertising. When I spoke to the Czech Republic's member of the European Commission, the conversation touched on everything from whether the likes of Facebook should fact-check political speech to the closing of European borders when the coronavirus hit the continent. You are the Vice President of the European Commission for Transparency and Values. Why does the European Union feel the need to promote certain values?
It's the first time the Commission has the person who is entitled to defend the values and transparency. It had a very serious reason because over last, let's say, 5-6 years, we saw suddenly clearly that the values are not given, that we have to do more to protect and defend the rule of law principle, that we have to do more to protect the people endangered by discrimination and inequality, and we need to do more to explain also the citizens that the freedoms are here for them, but they can be endangered as well. So that's my job. Some critics say that it's only speaking, it's not enough action. I don't agree with it because I'm now in the position almost 1 year, and I can tell you I had to do a lot vis-a-vis Poland and Hungary. Yes, words. Words are my instruments and I am using them.
Well, I wanted to ask you, what are the mechanisms, if any, at your disposal to penalize countries that flout EU values?
The mechanisms are enshrined in the treaty, and I use them to the extent of the competence I get. I am known as somebody who really doesn't want to be an activist, to go farther, but I am responsibly using the instruments. We have different procedures for different kind of problems. The Commission is the guardian of the treaty, and we have to pay attention to how the EU law is applied in the member states. In case we see gaps or problems, we have to act. And it relates to the rule of law principle, where we started several procedures which ended up at the court level. We have so-called Article 7 procedure, which has been launched in case of Poland and Hungary. And now I am really strongly promoting the idea that we should connect the EU money with the values, because the EU must not be seen as a bank machine or a cash machine, which is easy to get money from but not pay anything back.
In June, the European Commission issued a report saying that China and Russia were spreading false, misleading information online about COVID-19, and they referred to this as an infodemic. You yourself said at that time it would be too dangerous not to act. In this regard, what concrete action is the EU taking, or at least planning to take?
It was high time we did it. I was happy that we agreed on transparent communication and that we revealed the cases of disinformation attacks on the EU. It's too dangerous to be passive, because what we saw also, for instance, in case of Brexit, Brexit result was also very heavily influenced by the attack done by the disinformation. And what can we do? We will adopt the action plan to protect democracy by the end of this year. And I would like to achieve stronger protection of elections, because the time before elections is always very vulnerable and volatile from the point of view of the influence done by disinformation. I am looking into how the micro-targeting works, how the algorithms work in the social media world. We want to make the online political campaigning more transparent so that the people know that they are now reading something which is paid by somebody who wants something, who wants their votes. And we want to do more fact-checking, no censorship. I will always defend the freedom of speech. But I believe that if a politician uses the benefit, the advantage of social media, he or she has to count with the possibility that he or she will be fact-checked, or what they say. So fact-checking is an important part of our strategy. And the last thing, it will sound academic, maybe theoretical, but COVID showed to us that the sector which is under the disinformation attack has to defend its facts. And this is what we wanted from the ministries of health, from the WHO, to defend their facts, their arguments. And we wanted them to provide the people with the information so that we have active citizens who are not easy targets of disinformation.
What do you think, it's a big question, but what do you think ultimately is the aim of these countries like Russia, like China, that are spreading disinformation in the West?
I believe strong West is something China and Russia doesn't wish to keep. That's why they want to distract our societies. They want to decrease the trust of the people to democratic institutions. This is what we saw in COVID time, where we are still now. The very well-targeted and designed disinformation campaigns seek to abuse the fear of people. And this is all a very dangerous cocktail, which we really reject to drink in Europe. That's why we want to take several measures, which I named only some of them.
You mentioned earlier election campaign transparency, but I was wondering how important is that? Because this information may not directly support or undermine one candidate or one party, but it could just spread fear on issues, and that can have a knock-on effect to the benefit or to the detriment of some party. Can you regulate that?
Of course not. I don't want to regulate the content. I just want more transparency. I want the people to know that they are now objects of marketing, political marketing. I believe that we should look into how the marketing in online networks is organized, because the algorithms and the bubbles have been created to sell more products to consumers, but to use the same method to sell politicians to citizens. This is very tricky and dangerous. That's why I am looking at these things, at transparency and the processes, rather than the content. If the democratic politicians see that people fear of something, and we have many issues which make the people nervous, then the democratic politicians should be able to react on that and not to complain that the disinformators abuse that. So again, that's a challenge to come with a solution which will not bring any kind of censorship, but spreading trustworthy narratives and invest more into spreading the narratives.
Combating disinformation would seem to require the active involvement of Facebook, which is, I guess, by a long way, the biggest social network. But is Facebook itself not part of the problem? For example, Mark Zuckerberg said just a couple of months ago that social networks shouldn't fact-check political speech.
I was so happy when he said it. It was in a Congress. I was watching it very carefully. I believe that he is right on this matter. If I remember well what he said, you are accusing us of grabbing too much power without balancing it with the responsibility. And now, in this moment, you want to give us even more power to become the arbiters of the truth. This must not happen. This is already Jourová speaking. This must not happen. That's why we want to come with another mechanism and with a system when the people will have a better chance to understand which content, from which part, who is the owner of the marketing campaign. Maybe owner is not the right word. But I believe that the big tech must not be nor arbiter of the truth, neither the facilitator of the public debate. And we have to come back to normal. What we see in not only in Facebook space, but in many others, I call it privatization of public debate. We have to come back.
You mentioned fact-checking, but I often wonder, is fact-checking still important in a world that's often described as post-truth, where a president of a major country can spew 100 lies a day or a week or whenever? And if somebody fact-checks and says that's a lie, people who support that leader, they don't care anyway.
Should we give up? I believe not. Truth matters. I believe truth still matters. And post-truth era, I think we should agree on the fact that it's not what we want to accept as new normal.
You publicly welcomed Twitter's moves to flag misinformation being spread by Donald Trump. I'm kind of repeating myself maybe now here, but what can Twitter really achieve in that regard, given the sheer volume of false claims made by Mr. Trump?
Mr. Trump is using very successfully Twitter, especially. He's setting the tone for public debate. He's setting the subjects. The journalists are second ones. It's a new phenomenon. But Mr. Trump and many other influential people of this world should be aware of the incredible responsibility that, that the people are following them and believing them. And that's why I appraised and I applauded Twitter for adding the facts, which I understand as a competition of speeches rather than censorship. That's why I said, yes, it might be the way forward.
And is it even positive as a gesture? Because as I say, they can't do that every time.
Of course they cannot. And I never wanted them to establish some kind of internal Twitter or Facebook police. Maybe technically it might be feasible, but I never wanted them, for instance, to use artificial intelligence for detecting disinformation or hate speech. Because here, in these two categories of, let's say, harmful content, you have to be able to work with the language. And, for instance, for hate speech, which is a different story from disinformation, I always wanted Facebook and other big ones to work in all European member states' languages, to understand the case law, the decisions of the courts, what is defined as illegal hate speech in each concrete country, and you cannot use technology to detect it.
The European Union didn't have a great start to the coronavirus crisis. There was a strong perception that they abandoned countries like Italy and Spain to their own fates. Has the EU been seriously weakened by the whole pandemic situation?
I don't believe that. In the longer term, the EU might show that The first condition is that we are united and we are able to not only mobilize money, but also to mobilize solidarity. This is what was missing at the beginning of the COVID crisis. And we have accepted the criticism at the beginning. We were all shocked by the new situation. We could not trigger the normal mechanisms of civil protection, because in the EU we have the mechanism that if some countries are in big problems because of some earthquake or floods or and so on, the other states help. But suddenly we appear in the situation where all the states were affected by the same thing with different impact, which is calculable. All the member states were affected, but the impact also on economy is asymmetric. We saw that Greece, for instance, was not so badly affected from the health perspective, but the economic impact is incredibly high. So mobilization of money and solidarity and ability to coordinate and to look for common solutions. I think that we have made a big progress since March. And yes, it was the start was not our star moment.
I think for many ordinary Europeans, Schengen is one of the greatest benefits mm-hmm. of being in the EU. Were you concerned earlier in the pandemic crisis when borders were closed?
Yes, we were concerned how quickly it happened, that it happened by unilateral decisions of the member states without any consultations, not even with the neighbors. But it was the beginning. Now we do not want to repeat the same mistake. So now it's more coordinated. And when the states are closing the borders, they are doing it on the basis of the clear epidemiological situation. And I would be concerned if it lasts too long. So it was necessary. But we wanted to have this new strange regime only over the period which is strictly necessary. So we are working with the possibility of closing the border. We wanted, and the Commission did a lot, to keep the borders open for the goods, for the products, because we wanted the single market to keep going.
What did you think when some people in this country compared the situation during the state of emergency to pre-1989?
The feeling is strange when the border is closed. And especially in my generation, I can tell you a very strange reminiscence and a recollection of the moments when we were aware we cannot travel. But the ratio was different, of course. Now we understood why this is necessary, and we believed that the checks and balances, which guarantee also the freedoms, are still working. And in the Czech Republic, the courts worked, the parliament worked, the government asked for extraordinary powers under the scrutiny of the parliament and the public. So this was something which didn't exist before the 1989.
I was speaking there to Věra Jourová, the European Commission's Vice President for Transparency and Values, who very kindly visited our studio here last week. But I'm afraid that's all we have time for today on Radio Prague International. From me, Ian Willoughby, thanks a lot for listening, folks, and speak to you again very soon.